Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed conference reports on all major national and international medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I'm the Medical Science Officer at Medicom. In this podcast, we cover six presentations held at the International Federation of Psoriasis Association's 6th World Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis Conference, WPPAC, that took place the 30th of June to the 3rd of July, 2021. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to our healthcare workers for your continued sacrifice and dedication to the community.
So let's talk about deucravacitinib. It has a unique mechanism of action distinct from the JAK1, 2, and 3 inhibitors. It achieves a high degree of selectivity by uniquely binding to the TYK2 regulatory rather than the active domain of TYK2, which is structurally distinct from the regulatory domains of JAK1, 2, or 3. Deucravacitinib previously demonstrated efficacy and tolerability in phase 2 trials in patients with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis and active psoriatic arthritis. So the two phase 3 trials, the POETIC PSO1 and the PSO2 trials, looked at deucravacitinib as a once-daily oral selective TYK2 inhibitor and its potential to become an efficacious and well-tolerated treatment of choice for patients with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. So both these trials, the POETIC PSO1 and PSO2, were double-blind 52-week trials that randomized patients with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis with a BSA of greater than or equal to 10%, a PASI score of greater than or equal to 12, and SPGA of greater than 3 to placebo. Deucravacitinib 6 milligrams once daily or apremilast 30 milligrams twice daily. The POETIC PSO1 included 666 patients, and the POETIC PSO2 trial included 1,020 patients. The co-primary endpoints of PASI 75 and SPGA of 0 or 1 response versus placebo at week 16 were achieved in both trials. In addition, statistical significance was met for deucravacitinib versus placebo and apremilast for multiple ranked secondary endpoints. Significantly greater proportions of patients on the deucravacitinib versus placebo and apremilast arms achieved PASI 75 and SPGA 0 or 1 responses at week 16. Deucravacitinib responses increased beyond week 16 and were also superior to apremilast at week 24 in both trials, with a p-value of less than 0.001 in all comparisons. During the 16-week placebo-controlled periods, the most common adverse events were nasopharyngitis, upper respiratory tract infection, headache, diarrhea, and nausea. Adverse events were similar across all three groups. No clinically meaningful changes were observed in laboratory parameters during the two trials. Deucravacitinib was superior to placebo and apremilast across multiple efficacy endpoints and was well tolerated in patients with plaque psoriasis in these two phase 3 trials. These efficacy and safety results are consistent with the mechanism of action in this particular selective type 2 inhibitor. There might be some good news for patients with generalized pustular psoriasis, GPP. The first randomized placebo-controlled trial looking at an IL-36 receptor inhibition called spizolimab resulted in some rapid improvements in signs and symptoms of flares versus placebo, and it seems like there's some sustained effects as well. So we know that GPP, it's a rare but potentially life-threatening multisystemic and auto-inflammatory disease characterized by widespread recurrent flares of sterile pustules on the skin. Dysregulation of the IL-36 pathway does appear to be central in the pathogenesis of GPP, but currently there are no approved therapies for flares of GPP in either the USA or Europe. So in a phase 1 open-label study, a single intravenous dose of spizolimab resulted in rapid pustule clearance in patients with GPP. The Phase 2 FECAL-1 study was a 12-week double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial including 53 patients with the flare of GPP that evaluated the efficacy and safety of spizolimab. A GPP physician global assessment, a GPP-GA, pustulation subscore of 0, which is total pustule clearance, at week 1 was achieved in 54.3% of patients receiving spizolimab versus 5.6% of the patients receiving placebo, and a one-sided t-test showed that that was a p-value of 0.004. These results were sustained throughout the 12-week study. A GPPGA score of 0 or 1, which is clear or almost clear, at week 1 was achieved by 42.9% of patients receiving spizolimab versus 11.1% receiving placebo, and that was a significant p-value of 0.012. At week 4, 45.7% of patients who had received spizolimab achieved 75% improvement in the GPP Area and Severity Index, the GP-PASI, versus only 11% receiving placebo, and that risk difference was 34.6, so it's a one-sided p-value of 0.008. In addition, patients receiving spizolimab reported greater reductions in pain visual analog scale. Again, that was significant at week 4 versus patients receiving placebo. The overall safety profile of spizolimab was quite acceptable. Most adverse events were mild to moderate and similar between both study groups. Non-serious infection rates were higher in the spizolimab group at 34.3% compared with the placebo group, which was only 5.6%. But there were no patterns in pathogen or affected organs. Spizolimab treatment or flares in GPP was associated with a rapid pustule and skin clearance within 1 week and was sustained through 12 weeks. The overall safety profile for spizolimab was acceptable, with overall adverse event rates generally comparable between the spizolimab and placebo groups. These data support spizolimab as a potential therapeutic option for patients with a flare of generalized pustular psoriasis. Topic looking at unmet needs in cancer patients with underlying psoriasis has been whether immune checkpoint inhibitors actually will affect them or give them a different variety of adverse events. And so we know that immune checkpoint inhibitors are approved for many, many different types of cancers, both in combination therapies and as monotherapies. And retrospective analyses have demonstrated acceptable safety and similar efficacy of immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with autoimmune diseases. But they're often excluded in the trial situation due to concerns about immune-related adverse events happening. So even though immune checkpoint inhibitors have shown acceptable safety in patients with an autoimmune disease, disease flares and immune-related adverse events may still occur. And furthermore, outcomes of immune checkpoint inhibitor treatment in patients with psoriasis are not very well described. So this was a retrospective cohort study in patients with pre-existing psoriasis who received immune checkpoint inhibition treatment for cancer, and they were evaluated. There were 76 patients studied, 2/3 of which were men, 1/3 women. Median age was about 67 years. So they received the following immune checkpoint inhibitors. So 67% received some form of anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-1-like. 11% received anti-CTLA-4 antibodies, and like ipilimumab, and 22% had some kind of a combination of PD-1 or CTLA-4, like nivolumab with ipilimumab. All patients had pre-existing psoriasis, most frequently plaque psoriasis, that was 61%, and in some cases, about 20%, they had a comorbid psoriatic arthritis. Over half of the patients, 54%, had received prior therapy for psoriasis, and only 2 patients, 3%, were on active immunosuppression at the initiation of the immune checkpoint inhibitor. With immune checkpoint inhibitor treatment, 43 patients, 57%, experienced a psoriasis flare. Median time from the initiation of ICI treatment to psoriasis flare was about 44 days. Of the patients experiencing a flare, 53% were managed with topical therapy only, and only 5 patients, 7%, needed to discontinue the immune checkpoint inhibition therapy due to a psoriasis flare. So progression-free survival and overall survival were significantly longer in patients with a psoriasis flare versus those without a flare. The median progression-free survival was 39 for patients that experienced a flare versus 5.5 months for those who did not, and that was a significant p-value of 0.03. The median overall survival was not reached in those experiencing a flare versus 29.3 months for those who did not experience a flare, and that's also a significant value of 0.04. In this multicenter study, immune checkpoint inhibition treatment was associated with flares of pre-existing psoriasis. The majority of those flares were manageable with topical treatment, and a few patients required immune checkpoint inhibitor discontinuation. In addition, the occurrence of psoriasis flares really was associated with improved survival and progression-free survival. Is a known association between psoriasis and inflammatory bowel disease in terms of comorbidity, similar clinical course, and some overlap in genotypes. Even psoriasis patients who do not have IBD are more likely to suffer from gastrointestinal symptoms. So studies from the 1990s showed increased numbers of eosinophilic granulocytes and mast cells in the duodenal mucosa of psoriasis patients. And in ulcerative colitis, these two cell types are implicated in the increased intestinal permeability. This was a study presented by Professor Maria Lampinen from Uppsala University in Sweden, and she and her colleagues tried to investigate the role of these two cell types in psoriasis patients, and the current study included 18 patients with psoriasis and 15 healthy controls. None of the participants had any gastrointestinal diagnosis. Biopsy samples were collected both from the duodenum, because that's the first part of the small intestine, and from the sigmoid colon. There was no visible inflammation in the intestine of the patients, nor did the pathologist see any signs of damage. The Swedish researchers then analyzed the expression of several types of immune cells by immunohistochemistry and flow cytometry. And interestingly, they did not find increased numbers of eosinophils and mast cells, but they did find increased numbers of pro-inflammatory macrophages and cytotoxic CD8 positive T cells, which had increased the expression of activation marker CD69. Eosinophils were also activated with increased expression of CD66B, and that's a marker for degranulation. So these results actually suggest that even in the absence of apparent inflammation, the intestinal immune cells in patients with psoriasis has an increased potential for inflammatory responses. Really interesting. The winner of the Best Young Researcher poster was given to Dr. Georga Koplas, who talked about the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's underlined an urgent need for adequate treatment, especially in people living with psoriatic disease and other chronic illnesses. So during these uncertain times, many patients have been inquiring whether they should interrupt their treatment. So Dr. Jorge Georga Koplas from Toronto in Canada and colleagues demonstrated that very few patients, only 1.1%, discontinued biologic therapy due to concerns regarding COVID-19 complications. At the same time, the European and American dermatology guidelines published their recommendations to continue biologic therapy who have not tested positive or exhibited signs and or symptoms of COVID-19. The advice is to postpone biologic therapy in patients who have tested positive for or exhibited signs and symptoms of COVID-19. The current multicenter retrospective cohort study evaluated all adults and pediatric patients treated with a biologic for moderate to severe psoriasis since the onset of the global pandemic. Of 2,647 patients on biologic therapy who met the inclusion criteria, only 9 patients, so 0.3%, had a confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infection. Of those 9 confirmed cases, 6 were symptomatic and 3 were asymptomatic carriers. Also of those 9, 6 of them discontinued biologic therapy because of their COVID-19. These results suggest that interruption of biologic treatment should be reserved for clinically unwell patients because symptoms for COVID-19 positive psoriasis patients on a biologic were mild and no patients actually required oxygenation or hospitalization. The Nature Reviews Rheumatology Poster Prize went to Dr. Guajardo Yoroque for the poster Cardiovascular Risk Reclassification According to Traditional Cardiovascular Risk Algorithms and Carotid Ultrasound in Psoriatic Arthritis Patients. So due to a higher prevalence of cardiovascular risk factors and disease-related characteristics such as systemic inflammation, patients with psoriatic arthritis have a higher risk of developing cardiovascular event than, say, the general population. Although multiple algorithms do exist that can estimate the cardiovascular risk for the general population, no such algorithm exists for psoriatic arthritis patients. The existing algorithms underestimate the real cardiovascular risk of psoriatic arthritis patients, and this could be attributed to the fact that these algorithms do not include disease characteristics that can affect cardiovascular prognosis of psoriatic arthritis patients. Therefore, a carotid ultrasound should be done to correctly classify the cardiovascular risk of psoriatic arthritis patients and identify those who would benefit from an opportune treatment. The current cross-sectional, observational, and comparative study included a total of 75 patients aged 40 to 75 years who fulfilled the 2006 CASPAR criteria and 75 controls without psoriatic arthritis matched by age, gender, and comorbidities. The results were presented by Dr. Natalia Juajardo Iroquois from the Autonomous University of Nuevo León in Mexico. Cardiovascular risk was evaluated according to six cardiovascular risk algorithms, including the Framingham Risk Score Lipids, Body Mass Index, American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association Risk Algorithm, ASCVD, the Systemic Coronary Risk Evaluation, SCORE, Q-Risk 3, and the Reynolds Risk Score. Age and gender were similar in the two groups. Mean age was 54 years, and 57.3% were women in both groups. Results indicated that the presence of carotid plaque was more prevalent in psoriatic arthritis patients compared with healthy controls, at 44% versus 26.7%, with a p-value that was 0.026. When comparing the cardiovascular risk reclassification to a higher risk category, the difference was found in 5 out of 6 cardiovascular algorithms. The cardiovascular risk reclassification to a higher risk category after carotid ultrasound and presence of carotid plaque were more prevalent in psoriatic arthritis patients than in controls. Performing a carotid ultrasound as part of the cardiovascular evaluation of these patients is essential because cardiovascular risk algorithms are insufficient to identify patients who would benefit from an opportune treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. The 6th World Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis Conference, which was held the 30th of June to the 3rd of July, 2021. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed conference reports on all major national and international medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
you.